This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Prices at the pump? Let's talk about these last days of oil. After peak oil, there will be great volatility in prices. According to the best expertise, including the International Energy Agency, we are already long past that peak. A higher oil price can, after a delay of months or more, temporarily crash whole lines of business. Airline companies are often the first to fall, but everything from niche business to major corporations can totter into bankruptcy. Consumers find their wallets sucked dry into oil company and oil country revenues.
I pulled up to the pump, regular C95.5, plus C97.6.8. The good stuff is $4.05, 0.5.99 at 110. What the hell is that?
With reduced oil demand, prices drop, but not for long. Producers from Russia to the Emirates and Saudi Arabia are completing long-term diversification strategies, consuming more of their own oil in their own heavy industry. Meanwhile, the Asian economies continue rapid growth. Electrification and construction grow into consumer cities, fed by oil and gas all along the way. That's how those populations are sustained. U.S. politicians pander to price-protected drivers with suggestions of using up strategic petroleum reserves. China is building the most extensive oil supply lines ever known. They have announced and begun construction on a gigantic oil reserve system. A series of tank farms and other storage will house up to 500 million barrels of oil. To put that in perspective, Libya produced just over 1 million barrels a day. Canada produced 3.3 million daily, we are told, in 2008. The Chinese store of 500 million barrels allegedly equals 3 months of their current consumption. But that number is fuzzy. I don't know the real and current number for China's total daily oil use. I doubt anyone else does either. But they are storing it like gold in Fort Knox. In reality, when you need it, especially for a war, oil is more valuable than gold. Oil hoarding will push up prices even more. Now, picture hoarding in a time of falling production with a known limit to reserves. That is the next few years. At some point, price shock knocks the globalized economy into a coma, or worse. And none of this mentions a further minor barrier to continued oil exploration. Scientists, hordes of them, hundreds of thousands of them, are narrowing the knowledge gap about our atmosphere and our oceans. Climate change will batter is already striking the weakening energy model. We know now the atmosphere is far more sensitive than we thought. It isn't enough to stop greenhouse gas emissions. We have somehow to go back in atmospheric time to a maximum of 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalent. That level, at least 40 parts per million below current measurements of CO2 alone, might preserve the polar ice that powers our entire climate system as we have ever known it. Our current path is climate suicide. There is one very big reason why humans must reduce CO2 to survive. It is as large as humans can imagine for most of our time here. The oceans are heating up. But we are almost blind to this awful development. We know species are fleeing from tropical waters toward the poles. Other marine species are approaching the point where humans have to assist, like midwives, their current reproduction due to the extra heat. You will hear about that and much more from Dr. Alistair Hobday from Australia. Now I'm going to make my own claim, and this is the inspiration for this Radio EcoShock program. I say heating oceans will do three things, at least. They will exterminate some species, adding to the sixth great extinction, now taking place on land. they will flood the major cities of the world. And ocean heating will cost the global economy countless trillions of dollars. Probably the last item, the grubby money cost, is the only communicable news through mass media today. In the last part of the program, you will hear some of the most depressing climate revelations I've heard in 2011. That comes from a new radio program, The Climate Show, from Auckland, New Zealand. Twice the value now, a worthy summary of the latest alarming climate science set in a sample from a program I think you will like as an MP3 download or on YouTube. Stay tuned for details. But first, we'll start with an overview interview provided by a top scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California. He knows the oceans and he knows the climate. This is Alex Smith saying the state of the ocean may determine the fate of humanity and all species, not the atmosphere. We're going to talk with a marine and climate specialist, Dr. Joshua K. Willis, from the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California. His name is on some of the most important recent scientific papers evaluating what we know and what we don't know about the state of the world's oceans. Dr. Willis, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Josh, nobody likes it when carefully preconceived notions are contradicted by reality. Everybody knows when carbon dioxide goes up in the atmosphere, the ocean gets hotter. But in 2008, you were part of a team releasing a study saying sea temperatures did not change that much despite record hot years. What happened there?
Well, our knowledge about what happens to the oceans under global warming caused by greenhouse gas release really comes from a much longer record than just 1 or 2 years. We know that the oceans have been warming since about the 1950s, not just at the surface, but in a sort of volume average sense, so from the surface over depth as well. And we know that this contributes to sea level rise. As the oceans warm, they tend to expand and take up more space. But we also know that 80 to 90% of the extra heat that gets trapped by the greenhouse gases winds up warming the world's oceans. And so by measuring this warming, we're really charting how humans have been changing the climate over the last 40 or 50 years. What's really happened in the last couple years seems to be a sort of kind of natural fluctuation that's superimposed on the longer-term warming trend. We know that if we look far enough back in time, the oceans are definitely warming, and sea level is definitely rising. But the natural fluctuations like El Niño and La Niña, these can have a temporary speed up or slow down of this warming process. So it's really not that surprising that we might have a few years where there's less warming or less rapid warming than we would have seen over the last 50 years or so.
What are the mechanics of how the oceans warm? Is it direct sunlight hitting the ocean, or is it also this extra radiation bouncing back from our carbon-laden atmosphere?
Well, that's a great question, Alex. A lot of the heat energy comes directly from the sun, passes through the atmosphere, and warms the ocean. Remember that the oceans are two-thirds of the planet's surface, so a lot of the energy that gets into the oceans initially gets there from the sun. But this energy then gets radiated back up towards the atmosphere. Because the ocean's temperature is not absolute zero, it's also sending energy up towards the atmosphere. And the amount of energy that the atmosphere captures or absorbs depends on how much greenhouse gases it contains. So the extra greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide, methane, these actually trap more of the outgoing heat that's trying to escape back into space. So as we increase this layer, this sort of blanket of carbon dioxide over the atmosphere, we're actually trapping more of the heat that's trying to escape from Earth.
And we have predictions about global heating from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and these range from 2 degrees Celsius to 5 degrees Celsius hotter by 2100, depending on whether we act to cut emissions. Do we have similar predictions on how hot the ocean could become?
Well, there has been a lot of work done on ocean warming, and we know some of the broad strokes. The ocean is definitely going to continue to warm. As we add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, we essentially have to heat up some fraction of the ocean in order to eventually come into balance where we have the same amount of energy coming in from the sun as we have it going back out to space. And the ocean plays a really important role in achieving that new balance because, like I said before, 80 to 90% of the extra energy trapped by greenhouse gases winds up warming the oceans. So the oceans are playing an important role in the rate at which global warming happens, but also the degree to which it will happen as well. What the projections tell us is that we're definitely going to see continued heat being stored in the oceans. Even if we cut off emissions today, we will still continue to accumulate a certain amount of heat in the oceans. This will continue really for many years and perhaps even decades. So we know that there's a certain amount of continued ocean warming that's probably going to happen even if we stop emitting extra greenhouse gases right now.
And am I right to presume that there isn't a standard ocean temperature, that some parts are much hotter than others?
It's absolutely true that ocean temperatures differ everywhere in the world, from the tropics, where they're almost 30 degrees Celsius, to the high latitudes, where they're very close to the freezing temperature for seawater, which is actually minus 2. Generally speaking, as you go from the top of the ocean to the bottom, as you would expect, the water gets cooler and cooler as you go to the deeper layers. So really, when we talk about the oceans warming, most of the heat is actually going into the upper 15 to 20%, maybe even a little less, of the oceans. This is really the part that's interacting with the atmosphere and interacting with the climate. And it's this upper ocean that we really need to monitor the most carefully. But the deep oceans are probably changing as well. And just how much heat the deep oceans are absorbing is something we really don't have a good understanding of at this time.
You know, it's wild because it seems like exploring the ocean, it's so huge and there's so much we don't know. It's almost like exploring outer space or something, a Mars, because there's so much that we don't know. But I wanted to talk to you about some of the record hotspots that have been reported. About a month ago, we had Professor Matthew England from the Climate Change Research Center in Sydney here on Radio EcoShock. He reported very warm ocean temperatures off the coast of Australia just before the country's largest ever tropical cyclone, that was Yasi, hit the coast of Queensland. And just recently, the city of Darwin, right there on the northern coast, almost drowned with a record 24-hour rainfall of 13.4 inches or 339 millimeters with Cyclone Carlos. Are the heating oceans playing a role in these extreme weather events?
Well, this is a really great question. How much do the warmer oceans contribute to the storms that we see today? And I think the answer to that is still a bit up in the air. We do expect that in the future, we will have warmer sea surface temperatures. That's almost a given. I think the planet is warming up, and pretty much everyone accepts that it's warming up. And one of the main causes of this warming is the CO2, and that's going to continue. But really, how does the ocean interact with big storms? This is something we're still trying to figure out. Looking out into the future, it's likely that big storms could get bigger. We'll have warmer oceans, and warmth in the ocean is one of the fuels that drives tropical storms, hurricanes. But other factors are important, too, and just how those all will play out is still something that's a little bit uncertain. But we definitely know that we are going to be looking at warmer surface temperatures. And actually, in the Southern Ocean, this is one of the few regions where it seems like some of the warming that's been going on in the Southern Ocean really may be linked to human-caused climate change. But it's something that's just beginning to really become apparent. And certainly over the next 20 or 30 or 50 years, we're really going to begin to see the big impacts on the climate from the warming oceans and the warming atmosphere.
Well, here's another shocking anomaly. It took place over the sea ice in Canada's eastern Arctic. We had record low ice formation even in December with open water around the Ungava Peninsula and the north there in the eastern Canadian Arctic. And that's always frozen in December, but not this year. What have you heard about that?
It's true that we've had very low sea ice. Actually, there was, I think, a record minimum in sea ice extent in January this year. And if you look over the long-term record of sea ice the past 30 or more years, then you really see a picture of steady, not steady, but continuing decline. Of course, some years are bigger than others. Some years you lose a lot of sea ice. Some years you refreeze a lot of sea ice. But the long-term trend is really unmistakable towards decreasing Arctic sea ice, not just in extent, but also satellite measurements have shown that the height or thickness of sea ice has also decreased over time. So if you really look at the volume of sea ice in the Arctic, the long-term trend is unmistakable. We're certainly looking at smaller extent, less sea ice in the Arctic, both in the summer and apparently in the winter as well.
Do we know from measurements whether the oceans in the Arctic regions are getting warmer? And if so, is that affecting ice melt there?
The Arctic Ocean oceanography is really quite complicated. And there have been some results recently that suggest that water flowing into the Arctic at depth is getting warmer. But there's a big question over just how much the ocean drives the sea ice as opposed to changes in the atmosphere. We know that there's warming over the Arctic. As sea ice melts, you expose more water, which is dark, reflects less light, and causes more energy to be absorbed. We know that on the long term, sea ice is decreasing. But what are the mechanisms? Is it the ocean warming? Is it atmosphere warming? A lot of these things are still really up in the air. The long-term outlook is pretty much unmistakable, but a lot of the details are still things that we're uncertain on, that we still need to do more science and more study to figure out.
Right, and I should point out at this very time, the Canadian government is cutting some of its Arctic research money that might have found those answers, and they've rented out the scientific research ship to the oil companies to see if they can find some more oil. And we have a similar situation in the United States where right now the Republican House has decided that they will cut money to the IPCC even. It's going to be pretty hard to find out the information we need unless politicians get a little bit more aware of this.
Well, I think we do have to remember that I think as scientists, we really understand that times are tough, and we can't be ignorant of that. We really need to be careful about cutting our capabilities to see what's happening around the planet. As we look into the future, we're looking at changes in climate and changes in climate that are occurring faster and faster. As we warm up our planet, change our oceans, welcome or not welcome higher sea level, then we're really going to need the tools for observing these and the scientific understanding to help us figure out how to deal with them.
What kind of impacts of ocean heating do you think we need to research most?
Ocean heating is a big, broad question. It's important for a lot of reasons because, as I said earlier, 80 or 90% of the extra energy that gets trapped by greenhouse gases winds up warming the oceans. So measuring that number is actually really important for understanding just how much we're forcing the climate system. So that's really the big picture. But ocean warming also has a more local and more immediate impact. Ecosystems are pressured or can be pressured by ocean warming. Coral bleaching is exacerbated by warmer ocean temperatures. And these things are all pressures on the ocean ecosystems that we're really kind of piling on top of the pressures that we've already placed, like pressures from fishing, from use of the oceans. These things are very important, and you know, we're adding the ocean warming on top of that. But we're not just adding the ocean warming, actually. We're also adding a lot of carbon dioxide to the ocean itself. This carbon dioxide actually changes the acidity of the ocean, and that has an impact on the ecosystems as well.
Lately, you know, I did some research on this, and I did feel a growing sense of alarm. I think heating oceans, and this is just my opinion, could cost the world economy trillions of dollars, and that sounds over the top, but the Pew Foundation just released a study saying melting ice alone will cause $2.4 trillion in damage to the economy, and that doesn't count the storms or the loss of marine species that you spoke about. Have you seen anyone try to estimate the economic cost of making the seas hotter and hotter?
I don't actually know of studies looking at the economic impact of warming oceans and oceans becoming more acidic. I'm sure that people are working on that. I may just not be aware of it. But I think you can say, you know, broadly speaking, that we're having a big impact on our entire planet and its climate. And the oceans are really bearing the brunt of a lot of this change. And how are we going to deal with this? How are we going to adapt to it? And how much of it can we really mitigate by reducing our emissions? I think these are the big questions that we need answers to quickly. The basic answer is simple. Emitting the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is contributing to climate change, contributing to warming oceans, contributing to ocean acidity. Is it really possible to reduce our emissions? I think we have to give it a try.
Well, maybe at this point we need science fiction writers and artists to try and debate this subject, because a research scientist has limitations. You've got to stick to the science and the facts as we know them now. I looked for this term ocean futurist, and I found just a heavy metal band, a California painter, and a former chief NOAA scientist, the late Dr. Athelstan Spilhouse. Do you know of people who are willing to go out on a limb and extrapolating from the science to predict this future ocean?
Well, I think it's really tough, as you say, for scientists to crawl out on that limb and kind of extrapolate very far beyond what the data and the facts are telling us. But I agree. I think we do need folks who are willing to crawl out on the limb and be futurists, as you say. I think they play an important role in the kind of public debate that we need to have over this issue. But scientists, I think we do owe it to ourselves and to our colleagues and to our credibility to kind of stick with what we really know. And so I'm afraid I'm not going to crawl out on the limb just yet, Alex.
And I understand that. But I note that Jeremy Jackson of the Scripps Institution, he called for emergency action to save the oceans back in March of 2006. And we had a Canadian super scientist, his speech was called Lament for a Nation's Oceans. So there must be a growing concern amongst those who are studying the oceans now.
Well, I think there is a growing concern, and there's a concern especially among people who study the ecosystems of the ocean. I mean, I think we're beginning to figure out just how delicately a lot of these systems were balanced, and they really are important to the livelihood of a lot of people. And how much pressure can they take? I think that's the real question. And yeah, folks like Jeremy Jackson are definitely alarmed about the changes that they've been watching occur over their scientific careers. You know, I think ecosystems are really one of the places where we need a little more focus and energy to try and figure out what's going to happen. I mean, comparatively, the physics are, I think, better understood than what's going to happen to the fish. I mean, we can say pretty well that the oceans are going to get warmer, that sea level is going to rise. But what's going to happen to populations of, say, phytoplankton and all of the little critters that eat them and that we eventually eat that wind up in our food chain? I think that's a tough question and one that we really have to think hard about, both as a scientific community, but also as a society.
Finally, coming back to your own work for NASA, Dr. Willis, what are you working on?
I really do work on sea level rise and ocean warming. I study data from satellites that measure the height of the ocean from space. I think they're really cool. They can actually measure the height of the ocean with an accuracy of about 1 inch from 800 miles up in space, which is a really amazing technological feat. But what it tells us is that the oceans are rising. They've risen a couple of inches since the beginning of the records in the early 90s from space. And we can really see global change. In some ways, it's most apparent in the record of sea level rise. Sea level rise tells us about the ocean warming, but it also tells us how much ice has been lost from land. And these are two very sensitive measures of how we're changing the planet. But as we look out, you know, I live in Southern California, not too far from the beach. Sea level rise is here. We know from records up and down our coast that the oceans have risen about 8 inches over most of the California coastline. And this is having an impact on our beaches, on our coastline. Coastal erosion is accelerated in most cases by rising sea levels. We really have to start looking at this as a real global problem.
We have been talking with Dr. Joshua Willis, a specialist in both oceanography and climate change, working in NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Find links to some of his articles and papers in the Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for volunteering to help our listeners understand all this.
Thank you, Alex.
This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock as we continue to investigate the role of warming oceans from climate change. Our guest is Dr. Alistair Hobday, Senior Research Scientist at CSIRO Marine and Atmospheric Research in Australia. Welcome to Radio EcoShock, sir.
Hi, Alex.
Well, first of all, Alistair, can you tell us a little bit about the strange weather going on in Australia recently?
This year, Australia's in the grip of a very strong La Nina, which is a condition when the surface waters around the northern part of Australia are much warmer than usual. Warm water obviously allows more water to evaporate from the ocean into the atmosphere, and coupled with some cyclone activity, that's led to a very wet summer, I guess, for us down here.
And we've just heard from Dr. Josh Willis about the mechanics of how the ocean heats as greenhouse gases in the atmosphere change the energy balance of Earth. So that leads me to wonder whether some of this Australian storm activity is related to a warmer ocean in your area.
While it's hard to pin any single weather event on climate change, given that a warm ocean is occurring as a response to the increased greenhouse gases, you'd have to think that increased cyclone activity is a consequence of that warmer ocean. However, when we look in the historical record, there's been no clear trend in an increase in cyclone activity over the last 40 years or so. So that area is still controversial about whether we're seeing more cyclones. However, predictions from climate models suggest that we are going to see more intense events. And so this most recent activity in our summer is consistent with that expectation that we will see stronger and stronger cyclone activity.
Well, let's get to some of your own work. What sort of research is being done in your facility about the ocean and climate?
We have both physical oceanographers who are working on the actual physical changes, such as how is the temperature or the salinity or the pH of the ocean changing. And then within my team, we're mainly biologists who are looking at the impacts of those physical changes on the biology.
Well, let's get to some specific cases. What is happening for the species of the oceans as the water gets hotter?
On both the east and west coasts of Australia, we have currents that flow from the equator towards the poles, and those currents are bringing warm water then to the southern latitudes. A consequence of global warming is that not only is the water coming south already hot, global warming is somewhat heating it. So we're getting an enhanced warming on both coasts of Australia. On the southeast region, it's recognised that this is one of the climate hotspots for the ocean. These hotspots are areas where the temperature is increasing faster than other places. And as a result, we're seeing some pretty dramatic changes in biology at all levels in the food chain. For example, we're seeing phytoplankton species that are usually found in tropical waters occurring into southern Tasmania. A consequence of those phytoplankton blooms is that they also use oxygen, and they can make waters where you're fish farming more challenging for the fish that are living there. Slightly higher in the food chain, we're seeing things like zooplankton species also moving further south. And then the things that feed on the zooplankton are things like coastal fish species. And some recent work that we completed last year showed that about 43 out of 180 coastal species were moving south into southern Tasmanian waters. So these are really dramatic changes in the ecosystem.
So there's a migration of ocean species, perhaps toward the poles. Is that possible?
That's right. The problem is on the coast of Australia is once you get to Tasmania in the southern part of our continent, you run out of suitable habitat for many species. So if you're a fish that needs to live in water that's, say, 20 metres deep, you can move southward along the coast of Australia. But once you get to Tasmania, it's a long way south before you ever run into 20 metres water depth again. So animals are being squeezed at the southern end of their range, and that's bad. And that will probably lead to some reductions in population size. And ultimately, it may lead to extinction in some species.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.